Okay, that's it. So it's time for the Precious Metals Report. Franklin Sanders, are you with us?
I'm right here.
So the markets have been unbelievably interesting since we talked to you last. How about updating us on what's happened to gold and silver over the last 30 days?
Well, silver and gold had formed triangles, different kind. The gold was an even-sided triangle, the silver a flat-top triangle, if you can kind of picture that in your mind. And the even-sided triangle doesn't really tell us how it's going to resolve, but the flat-top triangle implies that it'll resolve to the upside. And in the last 2 weeks, they have both resolved to the upside. Gold broke out, went up to 1631, and then came back down, and for that, what I like to call the final kiss goodbye. It's something that markets do quite a bit. They break out, and then they return back to the line to the point where they broke out for a final kiss goodbye before they take off. So that's what we've seen in both silver and gold, and now they've stalled, and it's not really surprising that they've stalled. This is August, and although we have occasionally seen lows in August, most Augusts in the gold and silver markets are spent moving sideways. The gold is always dead during August, partly because in Europe everybody takes a vacation during August, and so nobody's working, and the market's usually is basically flat. So what we've seen is that we've got a good solid uptrend going on a breakout from a triangle, and gold is now slugging its way through that resistance between 1625 and 1630, and silver is pretty much following along. The analogous point for silver is probably 2860 right now. Once it gets through that, it'll jump, and then gold really doesn't have much resistance above that. A little bit at 1640, but mostly at 1680, and then it's smack up on $1,700 and ready to run further. So
right.
I think, you know, unless there's some really unexpected thing that happens before the end of the year, election notwithstanding, you could see gold significantly higher by the end of the year. You could see it at 1800, you know, and there is an outside chance that we might get some more back and forth. You know, it might run up to 1800 and then drop back to 1600 and scare this life out of everybody. But
right.
The worst of the correction is over. That's the point. And I found something interesting this afternoon after I talked to you, too. There was a Wall Street Journal blog entry today. Today marks the fifth anniversary of the beginning of the global financial crisis. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Do you have one of those little paper hats you can put on and one of those little noisemakers? Because this is an anniversary. This is the fifth anniversary of the day when the European Central Market injected 95 billion worth of euros of emergency liquidity into the market. And what two things do you think have performed best in the last 5 years? One of them
what?
You're going to know, but the other one will shock you.
Well, food is the one.
Corn
no?
and gold have both returned 144%.
Right.
Corn and
right.
gold. Third is silver.
Right, food, yeah.
And then oil, Brent crude is up 61%. So it's just very interesting that it's turned out that way. The things that people fly into for safety, like U.S. Treasuries, have returned only 38%. So all I can say is that our long-term strategy is working.
Right, although I'll tell you that if you look at last year, gold was up 8%, and so far this year it's up about 2%. And
mm-hmm.
It's actually maybe up a little bit more right now. But I didn't expect the extent to which some of the European and the U.S. stock markets significantly outperformed gold this year, which they have. So I think that's made, if you talk to people in gold and silver, they kind of feel like they've done badly the last year and a half, you know, because 2009 and 2010 was so good. But certainly we didn't get a good fourth quarter last year, and then so far this year it's pretty much been flat. It's kind of churning back and forth in a channel.
Right. But that's that correction, because, you know, what people have to understand is that there is no free lunch.
Right.
Markets move by fits and starts, and you get a great year 1 year, and then you get a correction following that.
Right.
And that's precisely what we're having to deal with now. And that's almost over.
I went back and I looked, and it turned out that gold was up double digits. If you go the last 12 years, gold was up double digits 2 years, up single digit 1 year, up double digits 2 years, up single. And that pattern's repeated itself, I think, 3 times. And so last year was the single digit. And so the question is, if it's double digit again this year, then I think, you know, people will feel like we're still in the pattern. If it's single digit, to me, you know, the question I have to ask is, do I want to rethink the, you know, what the pattern is? Because it does seem like there's a lot more tension by the central banks to keep gold from continuing to outperform other markets. I feel sort of like there's a political ceiling here that's very firm and stern.
You mean that their back is to the wall?
I don't, because I don't think their back is to the wall, but I do think they want to manage rise, and I think they're pretty clear about that. They can't afford for the bond market to unravel, and that means they can't afford for the stock market to fall too far behind gold or commodities.
Right, and it looked like to me, it's been several years since I did the check, but it looked like to me that they were averaging 15% a year that they would allow gold to rise. Or
right.
I say allow gold to rise. When it does that year after year, you have to say, well, look at that. That's quite a coincidence,
right,
isn't it? But you're mentioning treasuries really points up something that we may be on the edge of a cliff with, and that is there's been an enormous boom in treasuries this year where supposedly, and I'm not sure that this is true at all, but the way it plays out in the media, the way that it's touted in the media is that there's a flight for safety, and so people run into U.S. government bonds, specifically, you know, 30 and 10-year 10-year treasury notes, 30-year bonds. Well, I'm not so sure about that. The yield on the 10-year note has broken. It bottomed. There's been about a 2-month period that it's been bottoming, and in the last few days, in the last 3 days trading, it's gapped up twice, and it clearly has left a bottom behind and started back up. The interesting thing about that is on the days when bond yields rise, bond prices move the opposite way, so bonds fell. Well, what is a U.S. Treasury note composed of? Dollars. That's it, nothing else.
Right.
And yet the dollar, even though the dollar index rose today, bond prices fell. Yields rose. Now, at some time or the other, there'll be a flight out of dollars, and it will begin exactly like that. I wouldn't even say for certain that the yield has already bottomed. It looks like it has. It may take it, you know, that's a huge market, so it may take it months to bottom. But it will look that way when a flight out of dollars begins, when the bonds start dropping because people are getting out of dollars. And it did that in spite of the dollar rising. So the whole currency situation looks far more desperate to me than the small moves that we've seen in the last 2 weeks, because clearly Draghi's attempts to float the euro are starting to run out of steam. And he made some empty promises, and now the market wants to cash in on the promises. They want to see some cash. He simply can't do the sorts of things that have been floated because the Germans won't back him. And if the Germans are already on the hook for about €1 trillion for bailout.
Well, we've seen incredible skittishness in the last 2-3 weeks as the earnings reports come out, because the market is very much trading off of earnings. You've seen a couple of the most favorite popular stocks who came out earnings reports that I would say were very good, but not up to expectation. You know, so you get a corporation that was expecting a 10% increase, still got an 8% increase, which given the slowing over the last couple months is a very good performance, and their stocks get hit by 20 to 25% overnight, you know, boom, right down. And that's what happened in, you know, in the 2008 coming into the big drop. You saw that kind of skittishness in the most popular or the most overpriced stocks. So we're seeing that kind of skittishness.
Do you think that's a realistic market? I mean, if a company's worth $10 a share today, can it possibly be worth $7.50 tomorrow?
Absolutely not.
In other words, that it's ridiculous. I mean, a company, what are you buying when you buy a stock? You're buying a discounted flow of earnings. You're buying discounted for future revenue. And if it's
right.
that bad, there's something happened, you know, the headquarters has been blown up or something like that. But in the real world, you don't get that kind of drop that quickly.
Right, you're getting too much momentum trading. Now, another thing that happened, Franklin, was the CFTC closed out their silver investigation. And I was wondering if you had any comment on what you thought of that or what it means.
Oh, my goodness. Our customer watchdogs refuse to bark? My goodness. No, I don't have any comments about it because I never expected anything out of it anyway. I think it's a sideshow. I think if you raise enough noise, if you make enough noise and raise enough sand, then they'll have an investigation, and the investigation will discover there's not really a problem after all.
Well, they can't. I continue to believe those positions are U.S. Treasury positions through the Exchange Stabilization Fund, so they can't have a problem because they're government positions in the first place.
Exactly.
But there's always the
cover up of an alleged impartial investigation, and then you know in the extreme cases, to show you how useless it is, like in the Kennedy investigation, they seal up the investigation report and all the facts for 100 years or so that nobody can question the investigation's conclusions. Well, that's just silly.
Well,
but anyway, I didn't expect much. So.
Because of the slowdown, and again, you know, all sorts of signs of global slowdown, U.S. slowdown. I don't know if you saw it. I put up on the blog last week the garbage indicator. There's a dramatic decline in garbage being thrown away by Americans, which is a sure indicator of a slow economic slowdown. In that environment, I wanted to take a look at what. You know, what does it mean in that kind of slowdown to the price of gold and precious metals? And I thought Jim Popova had an interview, which I asked you to read this week, which I thought was very good. It's very good. So maybe if you could walk us through some of the points that Jim made and why they're relevant to the performance of gold in the slowdown.
Well, you know, the basic case that he made was that the institutional bias is inflationary. I mean, that the way the world is set up now, there's nothing else to do there's nothing else in the future but inflation. And so, you know, without going through every point that he made, he just points out that most people don't understand what deflation is anyway. Most people think that deflation is a fall in prices, but of course it's not a fall in prices. Deflation is a decrease in the money supply, and you haven't seen that anywhere. So the fact that we've had severely falling prices in housing, for example, since 2006, has taken place in an atmosphere where the Fed's balance sheet, I don't know, the money supply has probably grown 50%, 25 to 50%. And there has been no, quote, deflation, that is, decrease in the money supply. So the bias is overwhelmingly toward inflation. And there's just there's no way that deflation really can appear in that in these circumstances. For example, a lot of people think that debt collapsing is deflationary. But I go back to the example of the mortgage debt. That's huge amounts of debt collapsing, basically, and that causes a decrease in the price of all housing of all houses. But that certainly is not deflationary. That's prices dropping, but it's not deflationary at all.
Well, here's the question. Under what scenario would the central banks, I mean, two things can impact the money supply, grossly oversimplified. One is central bank policy, so printing or shrinking the money supply by the central banks. But the other is the velocity of money through the economy. So the slowdown of economic activity can, in theory, shrink the money supply, depending on how you measure it. But the central banks can always expand, you know, can offset that. Here's the question. Why would the central banks ever allow inflation to take hold as a policy matter? Why would they? That's where I have trouble imagining a scenario where we could see significant deflation, because I can't imagine why they would permit it.
Would permit deflation?
Yeah.
No, they won't. I think I've told you this, and I'm sorry to repeat myself if I have, but this whole thing became clear to me in an epiphany during a conversation with John Exter. John Exter was the vice president for gold operations at the New York Fed during the 1950s. He was just a wonderful fellow. He left the New York Fed, went to work for Chase, saw what was happening with the inflation, and pulled out in the early 60s and started recommending gold stocks and never looked back. But one of the things, he was very kind to me. He testified in my, came down and testified in both of my trials. I mean, he was just, I don't know why he was so kind to me. He's just that kind of person. And we were talking on the phone one time, and we were talking about inflation, deflation. He said, oh, he said, and he kind of dropped his voice, you know, when somebody's getting ready to tell you something really important. He sort of dropped his voice, and he says, oh, when that deflation takes hold, there's nothing you can do about it. And I just sort of stopped just a minute and remembered his background. See, he went to Harvard during the 1930s. He was there during the Depression and the early years of World War II. And so he had grown up in this atmosphere where the central bank was facing a deflation that could not be cured. Now, they inflated a lot. They inflated by devaluing.
Right.
But even with that devaluation and the following inflation, which was sponsored largely through government spending, still, there was another crash in 1938, worse than the crash in 1929. And so the point that he made just stuck in my mind. Of course, what I am hearing is mythic knowledge. And by mythic knowledge, what I mean is the myth that a culture is built on. And the mythic knowledge of central banking, and don't kid yourself, there's a culture there. The mythic knowledge of central banking is we must not, cannot allow deflation. It is to us what sunlight is to vampires. And so if you read the November 2002 speech that Bernanke made, in deflation not here, and look at the measures that he talks about, he's undertaken almost every one of those measures, and he reflects in that mythic knowledge in the central banking culture that at all costs, even at the cost of hyperinflation, they must fight against deflation, because once it takes hold, they cannot stop it.
Okay, but I want to talk about the Basel Accords, and to segue into them, what I want to bring up is the fact that there is not one money supply, because the money supply on Main Street versus the money supply, you know, in the centralized economy. So you have an insider economy, you have an outsider economy. Main Street and small businesses on the outside, local economies are on the outside, The money supply, in my opinion, on Main Street is shrinking, and which is why, in theory, if you could significantly increase the use of gold and silver as a currency or local currencies, you could get a whole bunch of economic activity going that is basically being shrunk right now because there's not sufficient money supply for the economic activity that wants to happen. So, and if you look at how the bailouts are working, you're constantly infusing money into the money supply, but it's all going to one side of the economy, and it doesn't, it's not leaking over on the other. So I think you do have a deflation on Main Street of enormous proportion, and it's quite dramatic.
If you mean by deflation, the amount of money that Main Street has available to spend, that certainly is true, because a lot of them are out of work, you know, or either that or they're foreclosed or they've got other kinds of problems. But even if they don't have those problems, they're certainly not spending like they would have. And they're afraid to spend. So certainly that, you know, that's a problem to the broader economy. But I'm not...
Well, all my feedback from Main Street and the smaller banks is there's a real effort by the centralized regulators to shut down credit. So let's talk about Basel III, because if it's bad now, what do you see what's going to happen when Basel III rolls out? And let me just introduce the Basel Accords are refer to a committee of central banks now currently of the G20 that meets at in Basel, Switzerland at the Bank for International Settlements. The BIS, as it's known, Bank for International Settlements, is a central bank to the central bank. So think of this as a convening of central banks of all the G20 major economies around the world, as well as Hong Kong and Singapore. And they meet on this committee and come up with global standards for capital and other sort of regulation and enforcement, really dealing with the soundness of banks, and put out recommendations. And then it's up to sort of the countries on the committee at a national level to implement it. So there can be a long period of time between when an accord is reached and the specifics go into implementation and financial regulation in any given country. The first Basel Accord was in 88, the second in 2004, and then when the financial problems occurred in 2008, a new one was created, Basel III, which was published in 2010, 2011. And now we see this summer in June, the Federal Reserve, the OCC, and the FDIC putting out a notice of proposed rulemaking. Are you ready for this, Franklin? It was remember, this is coming out at the beginning of summer, so when everybody goes on summer vacation. So right in the middle of everybody's summer vacation, they plop out a notice of proposed rulemaking to implement. It's a modified version of Basel III integrated with the Dodd-Frank legislation. So the complexity is mind-boggling. It's 750 pages long. They plop it out at the beginning of summer, and you're ready for how many days they gave people to give comments? 90 days, which is a very... Very short. I mean, this is kind of, I won't use the F word, but you know, this is kind of in your face. But here's what was very interesting. The Wall Street Journal reported a conference call with small bankers a couple days ago, and I just have to read it because I can't imagine this happening. This is amazing. It was supposed to be a routine conference call where bankers could ask U.S. regulators about a proposed rule on capital levels. The Fed was running a conference call. You could dial in. And then a man who identified himself as a fourth-generation banker from central Minnesota started to complain about the possibility of having to set aside much more money when making non-traditional mortgage loans. As about 1,500 other bankers listened, the banker pressed officials at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, that's at U.S. Treasury, to justify the proposed changes, saying he had made such loans for 40 years with almost no defaults. Then came an 8-letter barnyard epitaph. OCC officials cut him off to take another question, but the next three bankers in line said they agreed with him as well. Okay. So the Fed's just announced that they're delaying the comment period another 45 days. Now, I want to talk about what this means to gold, but first let me tell you what it means to Main Street. Essentially, what... From my read, and we published, I had my attorney go through and get really detailed notes on what this could do and the specifics, and we're going to post the notes up on the blog post so you can read it there. But essentially what this does, Franklin, is it takes all the different ways that small business finances itself through small banks, and it makes them much more expensive and harder for the banks to do. Now, it significantly raises capital requirements, particularly equity capital across the board. You know, in fact, a lot of small community banks are pretty good on that score. But it significantly raises the cost of capital and the cost of equity capital. But then what it does is slams non-conforming mortgages. It makes small businesses loans. There's been some reports that it eases up. I don't see it at all. But it really hits commercial real estate hard, which is, of course, how many small businesses don't finance their business. They just finance their office or their building. And so if you look at it, you can certainly understand why the bankers on the calls went nuts. But it's a real slam on Main Street. And if anything, it basically, to me, it helps the guys who caused the financial crisis and slams the guys who didn't make money on the financial crisis. So if anything, you know, it moves, as I've described, us to a utility model for banks. You have much more central banker control. And frankly, you know, one thing I will say, it's the guys who now have consolidated control of all the gold are really in the catbird seat. So, you know, this is how, once you've won and stolen all the money, you get lockdown. It's quite severe.
You do it by regulation.
Well, you basically say, okay, we're going back to where we were before we pumped this thing. And, you know, we're going back to having a reasonable amount of equity. You know, on the face of it, it sounds wonderful. More equity capital, more thoughtfulness in how you rate different categories of things. You know, there's more complexity in the risk weighting system. But essentially what it does, it gives immense power to the central banks and top-down control. Now, let me just mention gold, because there have been all sorts of reports that gold is moving to a zero risk weighting, and I thought that was true from some of the reports, but having gone through and having my attorney gone through all 750 pages as well as numerous summaries, it's silent on gold, which is very strange, and says to me, you know, something surprising could pop out top down on gold. Gold is now mentioned as collateral. It's really technically an other asset, so it's quiet in the risk rating, and again, it's added as a potential collateral. What it says to me, though, if you look at the whole construct of what they're doing, it's going to make gold even that much more important, and I continue to believe it's going to be one of the critical, if not the critical, settlement, you know, mechanisms at the big bank and central bank level. So,
In this latest transmogrification, does it say that gold is a zero risk weighted asset, or is it still in the 50%?
Completely
class?
Silent. It's complete in the risk weighting that I can find. It's completely silent. We've gone through 750 pages and numerous summaries. It's just listed as other assets, and it's silent. But I think if you look at the entire model and construct, the guys who have the gold are even more so in the catbird seat. Now, what's interesting is it's moving back much more to a utility model, and the innovation is flipping to the digital side of the house. So I think where you're going to see the creativity and the wild and crazy stuff going on is the shift to digital currency. And so the basic banking business, they're getting back to a much more grounded utility model, you know, like in the old days, but one that's much more consolidated. Right now we have about 7,300 banks in the United States, and if you look at, you know, what happened on this call, I think the clear notion coming from a lot of bankers is, you know, you're pushing the mortgages into Freddie and Fannie, and you're making the small business that much more difficult. Now, I'm going to say something that you and I have been saying for years, which is, if anything, this underscores the importance of building ways of circulating money, including equity capital, outside the regulated systems. Now, that's something you and I have been trying to do for years, and frankly, it hasn't happened yet. But it needs to happen, because if you look at how draconian the regulated systems are going to be, there's an enormous opportunity if we can start to create liquidity outside of them.
Well, what you're describing is they are making impossible borrowing from a bank for a small business, you know, somebody that does less than $10 million a year. There's just not going to be a way they can borrow from a bank, because the number of hoops that you have to run through just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the kind of banking that has been done by small banks, which is, you know, they loan on character, let's face it. They loan on character. They know the character of the person. They say, yeah, this person's a good risk, because I know that if he has to sell everything in his house, he'll pay the loan back. So, yeah, it's certainly...
See, what they're making the small banks do is collect out the deposits and then put their money in the investment portfolio and treasuries instead of lending to small business. So government is basically regulating so that they can borrow the money as cheaply as possible instead of the banks loaning it to Main Street. So what you're seeing in the regulation is a face-off between Treasury financing the government versus the banks financing small business. In other words, is the deposits going to shoot to Washington and Wall Street, or are they going to circulate locally?
Well, let me turn that lens just a little part of the turn, and say that it's another step in the shift from production to speculation. You see, those small banks make loans for production.
Right.
They don't make loans for speculation. But what they're being forced to do, as you explain it, is they're being forced to stop making loans for production and become intermediaries for speculation.
That's if you look at how they're locking down the whole system, I think the speculation is moving more out of the banking system. And the reality is where it's going to go is not as much speculation, which is where it's going now, but into the government's hands to build global empire and pay Social Security checks. So the speculation comes with what's the government going to do with its budget.
Well, in the end point is for all of us that entrepreneurs are going to find it much more difficult to get financing.
Unless we build alternative mechanisms. And I refuse to give up on that, because the minute we say, you know something, this is what it's going to take to survive, to build ways of, you know, I mean, we're just going to have to go to massive angel networks. But until we find ways of financing each other and using each other's services, you know, this is going to get that. What this says to me is the squeeze is going to continue in a big way. So the slow burn is going to take a really big step up, because the small banks in this country have done an incredible job of keeping liquidity going. You know, if they hadn't been there, things could be much, much worse.
Yes.
Anyway, so if you're not banking locally, you definitely want to do that. Okay, so can we turn to Let's Go to the Movies?
Go ahead.
Okay, anything else, though, before we start on the gold and silver market for the next 30 days? Any thoughts about what we're looking at?
You know, the one thing that might slow things down is as we get closer to the election, the markets can be counted on to sort of hold their breath if it looks like it's not clear whether Romney might win or not. I frankly think Obama's going to be reelected. And that might slow the markets down. And if Romney did get elected, then that probably would be that might slow gold and silver down for 4 or 5 months until it became completely obvious that Romney's going to do the exact same things that Obama would have done. But the point here is that there is no fundamental change in our underlying strategy, which is that the inflation is going to increase, and that's what drives the prices.
Right, no matter who the candidate is or who the president is.